Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Helbert. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll speak with Shannon Woolley, the artistic director of the Looking for Lilith Theater Company. First, the marble-lined rotunda of Kentucky's State Capitol building was the backdrop last week for the presentation of the 2006 Governor's Awards in the Arts. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh reports on the nine recipients.
Administered by the Kentucky Arts Council, the Governor's Awards in the Arts are the state's highest honor in the arts. And Governor Fletcher says the recipients exemplify the state's unique and diverse cultural heritage.
Arts and humanities are extremely important, and we believe that not only from a standpoint of its intangible aspects, but also from the tangible aspects of economic development.
This year's Artist Award, honoring lifetime achievement in the arts, went to former University of Kentucky basketball player LaVon Williams, a fifth-generation woodcarver and folk artist from Lexington.
Some people do it once in a while, but every day I either draw something, I carve something, else I put something down. Every day. There's not one day that I don't. So it's like eating and breathing.
Music is something that's relaxing. You know, you can have something on your mind and be worried maybe a little bit about something. You sit down and take your fiddle or your guitar, banjo, whatever it is, and you sit down and start picking a few tunes. It's not long till it all drifts away. You got no worry. You go study about your music. It's a change of mind. That's what it is.
Father and daughter, Lewis and Donna Lamb of Lancaster, received the Folk Heritage Award for their contributions to promoting and perpetuating Kentucky's unique artistic traditions.
He said, if you're going to learn to play this, you know, you've got to set your mind to it and say, I've got determination, I'm going to do it. And if you can ever get through that first song, you've got it made.
The Education Award went to the Russell Orchestra, an arts program of the Russell, Kentucky Independent Schools. The orchestra, which has over 300 student members, is directed by Jason Chapman.
The era of education that we're in is not a good one for the arts. We have standardized, tested kids just out of everything. And so most music programs are struggling. And so that's a sad thing. It's the time we live in, and hopefully it'll change. And we're doing our best to help things change.
The Business Award went to Jewish Hospital and St. Mary's Healthcare for incorporating folk art into their facilities in Louisville and Bullitt County. The Community Arts Award went to the Kentucky Book Fair, the Government Award to the Pike County Extension for Fine Arts, and Morehead State Public Radio won the Media Award. Paul Hitchcock is WMKY's general manager.
A lot of stations are one format or possibly two formats. We try to offer a variety of things, and we do, from classical music to Americana and bluegrass music and blues, storytelling, health programs.
Radio KGRK, the voice of Northeast Arkansas, bringing you
Academy Award-winning actress
Face
Patricia Neal of Whitley County is the 2006 National Award winner.
The arts have been a very important part of my life. I hope they will also be for the people of Kentucky, who will always be in my heart.
And the 2006 Milner Award for Outstanding Individual Commitment to the Arts and their role in the economy, community, and culture of Kentucky went to Sandy Speer, retired director of Actors Theater of Louisville. Each of the nine recipients was awarded a beautiful mixed-media art piece of wood and stained glass entitled Kentucky Ablaze by Lexington artist Dan Neil Barnes.
Congratulations again to all the recipients. Thank you.
For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
A local theater company that reexamines history and its plays through the eyes of women is celebrating its fifth anniversary. To mark that milestone, the Looking for Lilith Theater Company is remounting one of its most acclaimed productions. It's set in World War II and has begun a two-week run at the Rudyard Kipling on West Oak Street. The company will also host an appearance by the daughter of Rosie Will Monroe, better known in World War II promotional films as Rosie the Riveter. I recently spoke with the company's artistic director, Shannon Woolley, about the production. We'll also visit with Rose Monroe's daughter, Vicki Croston. Shannon, tell us a little about the group and why this year's performances are so special.
Well, we are a women's ensemble theater company. We are based here in Louisville, Kentucky. We moved here from New York City 2 years ago. And we are dedicated to reexamining history from women's perspectives and then creating original performance pieces based on that examination. And this is our fifth year anniversary, so 5 years of bringing women's history to life. And we're celebrating by remounting one of our most popular shows, What My Hands Have Touched, U.S. Women in World War II, which is based on interviews with women about their experiences during the Second World War. And one thing that really makes this year's performances special is that Vicki Crosston, who is the daughter of Rose Will Monroe, Rosie the Riveter, is one of the people that we interviewed when we were originally creating this script, and she is coming in from Houston to attend our gala performance and to speak a little bit about her mother. So we're really excited about that.
And Vicki is on the line with us. Hello, Vicki.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm just gorgeous. Beautiful blue Texas morning.
Well, for those too young to know, tell us about your mother, better known to the rest of the world as Rosie the Riveter.
You know, she was like any mother, I guess, at the time. I'm a post-war baby, so I wasn't around when she was actually working as Rosie, but just a dynamo of a lady. She truly exemplified the we can do it spirit, and she just she demanded excellence of all her kids, and when she did something, she not only did a lot of different things, she did them all very well. A great lady, good role model, good, honest, moral, ethical lady, and great work ethic. So I've grown up to respect and honor that, and she just exemplified the team effort that we needed during World War II.
How did she get to be such an icon or a symbol for the many, many women who went to work in factories helping with the war effort?
Well, you know, her history at the time was she had been widowed, and she had two small children, and lived in Kentucky. She had heard of work up at the bomber factory in Ypsilanti, Michigan, so she decided, okay, I'm going to take my kids up there. I'm going to get a job. She knew that there was decent money to be made, and as the sole supporter of her family, she knew she had to do that. So she loaded up my brother and sister on the bus, and off they went to Michigan. And one of her coworkers had a family, mother and father, I believe, who lived outskirts of town, and mom kept the children with this other family. She would bus them in on weekends. They'd put her name on their little tag and bus them in. But mom lived there in the barracks at the aircraft factory. Well, she happened to certainly have the name Rose, and she was a riveter. So at one point, the British actor Walter Pidgeon was on site filming some War Bonds promotionals. And mom's foreman said, we have a lady here who fits the stereotype of the Rosie the Riveter song, which had been already published and was popular at the time. And he asked mom if she would be interested in being the Rosie in these promotional films and actually put a human face to the Rosie icon. And mom certainly was honored to do so. So thus began a face to Rosie, and I just happened to grow up with that.
You came along a little bit later. I don't want to get specific, but you on the year, but you came along a little bit later, so you knew all about it, I'm sure.
But you know, we weren't raised with thinking we had this big famous person in the family. That was never, ever, ever part of it, which I think is kind of typical for any of our World War II veteran era generation. But we knew what she did, and we knew that was just the first of a long line of jobs that she held, and she was, you know, honored to do so.
Now, you're coming to Louisville to speak. Is this something you do elsewhere?
I do. I've been honored to be able to represent my mother in lots of other venues, from the World War II Memorial to the Rosie the Riveter stamp, the Celebrate the Century 40s issue stamps, to the Rosie Park in California. So I get to speak fairly often about that.
Shannon, let's go back to you for a moment. The Lilith Theater Company, where do the actors come from? Do you get them from auditions? Are they professional actors?
Well, we are an ensemble company, which means that all of our plays are created by the actors that are in the play. We do all of the interviews and research ourselves, all of the transcription of the interviews ourselves, and then we devise the play in rehearsals. So the actors that will be performing in this play are actually the actors that created the play. It is being directed by Kathy E.B. Ellis of the Pleiades Theater Company, and we're performing at the Rudd.
When is Vicki coming to town?
Friday, the 23rd, is our gala performance to celebrate our fifth-year anniversary. And that's going to be a really special evening with dinner at 6, and then a conversation with Vicki, and then the performance will be at 8 that night. Tickets are $12, $10 for seniors and students, The gala performance with dinner is $40, and you can reserve tickets at the Looking for Lilith office. That number is 638-2559.
Well, Shannon and Vicki, thank you for joining us, and good luck with the play.
Well, thank you for having me.
Rick.
The Looking for Lilith Theater Company's production of What My Hands Have Touched can be seen at 2 p.m. today. There are also performances at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday and Saturday. And Friday's 5th anniversary gala featuring Vicki Crosten begins with dinner at 6 p.m. More information is available by calling 638-2559 or visiting our website, wfpl.org, and clicking on Studio 619. When we come back, WFPL brings you a portion of Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher's address to the Downtown Rotary Club last week. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up a little later in the show, Robin Fisher talks to the Louisville Improvisers about their brand of comedy and why it's harder than it looks. First, Ernie Fletcher is in a unique position for a sitting Kentucky governor. After months of a merit system investigation in which members of his staff were indicted, he pardoned all of them and anyone who may have been implicated in the case in the future. The charges against him were dropped in an agreement with the Attorney General. Now some people within his own party are questioning his strength as a candidate for re-election in this year's governor's race. He faces two Republican opponents in the May primary. The governor traveled to Louisville last week to speak to the Downtown Rotary Club. Here is part of his address.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. Thank you. Jim, it's great to be back. I too, am very disappointed that Woody wasn't here to introduce me. We were hoping that Woody's a good friend, he and Ann both, and we certainly wish them the very best in most endeavors. I was here, and as you may recall, campaigning for governor in 2003, and let me say unabashedly that the health and strength of the Commonwealth is much improved from the time that I was here. And we've got a great team that's worked to help us do that, but it's really you all. Government can only create an environment of prosperity, but it takes the people, the business folks, the innovators, the workforce, the educators, local leaders, all of those individuals that really create the prosperity. If we can create the environment, the talent of people, if it's unbridled, can create the wealth, the strength, and the health of communities in the Commonwealth. So I want to say thanks to you all. Jim, thank you for your leadership and a very kind introduction. Carl, appreciate you as well, and Skip. Miller is, as you know, executive director of Louisville Regional Airport, which has been a tremendous, tremendous impact on Louisville, and not only Louisville, but the economic growth of the Commonwealth as a whole. I want to recognize a few other folks. Brad Calgo is a Rotarian from Lexington. Brad's our budget director. Brad, stand up, and he's... Let's see if that'll fit in there. Not quite. One more, but let me say a little something about Brad. Brad was, I think, a number of years ago with Wyatt Terry Combs with Stites and Harbison. You were kind of a mentor of Ned Breathitt. Good friend I met in junior high school. We played in band together. I played the saxophone. I believe you played the trumpet. And we got to know each other at that time, came back together as I was running for governor. He's been a leader in Lexington. He's done a tremendous job as budget director. And a lot of the accomplishments we've had has been in due part to Brad, his leadership, and the other team we've put together. So, Brad, thank you. Mary Davis and John May have been recognized in the Revenue Cabinet, and I'll show you a few numbers from the Revenue Cabinet. They're doing a tremendous job over there as well. What I'd like to do is just take you. I've said the Commonwealth is healthier and stronger than it was when I got there 3 years ago. I think you all are very much aware of that. But what I'd like to do is kind of take you through a few values that we brought to Frankfort, values of making sure that we had a government run with fiscal responsibility, making sure we did things and tried to get up every day and do the right thing. Some folks have made some comments on the politics of this administration. Well, let me say, our politics have been policy. And I think you'll find when I show you the results that it's the best politics as well when we tell that story. As when we came in, we had some deficits, projected billion-dollar deficit. In fact, the Courier-Journal and the Herald-Leader, a lot of the editors, a lot of the media folks said, Fletcher, you need to raise taxes. If you don't raise taxes, you're not going to be able to meet the needs of education and the services that state government needs to provide. In fact, if you look at the very early on, we had $302 million to make up in the first few weeks in office. I remember the time when Brad came over to the office with the budget staff and said, Governor, we've got to do a budget reduction order to the tune of $302 million. Otherwise, we're not going to have checks that are going to be solvent. We're going to start bouncing checks here pretty soon because we don't have the revenue coming in. And this was below what was already budgeted, so this was expenditures that were budgeted. Well, we immediately made some cuts. We didn't make a lot of friends in the first few weeks because we cut across the board. We reduced the number of cabinets. We also scraped up as much money from as many funds as we could. We tightened up the amount of growth of government. In fact, we said, you're not going to grow. We're going to reduce you by 0.4% right now in the next 6 months. Now, we cut everything except primary and secondary education because we felt that was very, very important and that we could get money from every place else. But what we did was we took that, and here's where we are now. And we'll talk about how we got there, but the fact of the matter is these were the numbers that we had, and this is just the rollover from an end of a budget year to the next. That's how little we had, and these were after budget cuts. These were after the deficits and then a budget reduction order was made. If you look at where we are now, it's a little over $700 million that we've had in surpluses since we've been there. We also, contrary to what was recommended, were able to make historic investments in education. And we realized our purpose was to make sure we restored hope and opportunity. Opportunity was the single word we talked about so many times. And we said if we can feed and invest in areas in education and in our economic engines. And let me say I've been not bashful about saying that Louisville is our single most important economic engine. And as Louisville goes, so Kentucky goes. And we have recognized that and made investments here. And it's been good for the folks in Pikeville and Paducah as well. And we've told them that. Because if we can invest money here and increase the growth of Kentucky, then we'll be able to make sure that we can provide the services all across the Commonwealth. So we see Louisville as an asset, and we've used that asset very wisely, I think, in the last 3 years. Education, let me show you what we've done in education. This was the funding over the last few years, and in fact, this is what we have as we've been there. This is it was described as the best bipartisan, bicameral budget in nearly the last two decades, at least the last decade since 1990, that the Commonwealth has ever seen. What did we do in this area? We increased teachers' pay 10.5%. And that's so important for these counties that are on the borders because we compete with other states that are paying our teachers more. And we had a problem of losing quality teachers. We also felt like it's very important that we extend the school year, and we extended it by a couple of instructional days because we were below the regional, national, and well below the international average on the number of instructional days we have in our schools. And yet we've got to compete because education is the crux of economic development in a knowledge-based economy which we're in. And as you know, we compete not just with Tennessee or Illinois or Indiana, Ohio. We compete with Japan. We lost one plant to Poland. And we don't like to talk about what we've lost because we brought a lot here, but the fact of the matter is that we compete on a global economy, and when businesses are looking at locating, with the world as small as it is because of technology, we've got to compete globally. So our education has to be second to none. And we increased two instructional days. We also put $70 million in technology, and that's extremely important. We put workstations, but we put those big data pipes there so that we could get from KET, Mac, I know you're here, KET, we can get that instruction. Now we can hook up, we'll be able to hook up our universities, our community colleges, our primary, secondary education, and teachers now, when they go to get their postgraduate education and get their master's degree and further education, can take courses that are in the course they're instructing rather than just in the pedagogical education under the College of Education. They can get it under the College of Arts and Sciences now that we'll be able to pump that in. It's called Embedded Professional Development. And it's a direct impact on student achievement when the teachers have more instruction in the area that they're teaching. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true. If you learn a little more about math or physics or biology or whatever you're teaching, you actually see a student improvement of those you're teaching. And so that's what we did. We also fully funded preschool, which first time had been done, up to 150% of the poverty level, because we felt it was very important to get those kids early. We also put $44 million in the Read to Achieve. I know you all have a reading program here that we invested with you in, and it's a great program, but Read to Achieve is working. I told this story a while ago. We had one student write back the First Lady and say, you know, I had trouble reading. Now I can read. And he said, I'm aspiring to be the President of the United States. Well, the First Lady was very pleased and wanted to be the President. I was very pleased and wanted to be President. I was glad he didn't want to be Governor. We do have a few in the race. Post-secondary investments, we've invested more than this state. Matter of fact, I can say unabashedly we've invested more in 4 years than the previous administration invested in 8 years. And that's a statement that we can say because we realize that investing in post-secondary education is extremely important. We've done well with the University of Louisville as well. In fact, I think it's up. And when I get to the end, I'll talk about restoring the veto projects. We already were up to $147 million in 4 years. We'll be over $200 million at the University of Louisville investments in just 4 years in our capital projects there. That means there's more lab space for creating that intellectual property. There is more availability there, if you will, to accommodate more students in higher education than we've ever had. We also, in our community colleges, a little louder, it's not catching on. I'm still waiting for my honorary degree from the University of Louisville, too, but I don't know if I'll get that. And KCTCS, and we know the Jefferson Community College, we put in money for the Allied Health Center, and that's extremely important. It's obviously a very important part of the economy here in Louisville. We have an outstanding medical community and industry here in Louisville. But we've invested in this all across the state, and we've started putting some of these community colleges and tech colleges right on our industrial parks. We did that in Bowling Green. We've done it in Ashland and other areas we're doing it. Lifelong learning is what we're focusing on now. When you have an individual working in a plant, they get new technology in. There's upgrading and skills that are needed. We want to make sure we've got the schools right there available in their community so that they can get that education, and we're working very well to do that. This investment is giving us a good return on investment already. Baseline funding, again, we had a lot of folks say, if you don't raise taxes, you can't fund education. Not true. We've cut the size of government. We've grown the economy. We have made government operate a lot more efficiently, and we'll show you some of that. And that gave us more money to invest in education. So even our base funding for education has increased substantially. We've also invested in infrastructure. We put more in water and wastewater around the state than they ever had, an 88% increase annually. We've also reduced the size of government, as I mentioned, just in the transportation cabinet alone by reducing over 1,000 employees and changing our change orders, reducing the average percentage of change orders from 11 to 12%, which had gone up to 24%, down to 2.7% this last year. We've been able to save more than $80 million. There it has 67.2. Now it's about $80 to $90 million plus annually that goes into roads and bridges, and that's why we've been able to do so much. And we have had the largest, if you will, road projects in the amount of contracts in the history of the Commonwealth last year. We went over $1 billion. We realized that roads and infrastructure are extremely important for jobs. 74% of companies locate within just a short distance of a four-lane highway or an interstate, 90-some percent within a nationally truck-designated route. And so infrastructure and roads are extremely important for economic development. even in a knowledge-based economy. We have healthier citizens and stronger communities. We passed, and I remember being here in 03, you all were very supportive of increasing the cigarette tax. Now, let me say we did that, increased it from 3 to 30 cents. But what we did was we took that money, nearly $150 million, a little less than $150 million annually we got from that, and we took 500,000 people off the tax rolls and reduced the income tax on 78% of working Kentuckians. So we didn't take that money and put it into the coffers and grow the size of government. We took it and reduced the burdens. We also reduced the taxes on businesses by nearly 30%, and we have been able to grow the economy. But one of the things we've seen here is a substantial reduction. We've got a long way to go. We still rank number one in smoking in the United States as far as the percentage of our citizens that smoke. But it is having an impact, and it is working. We're doing our Get Healthy Kentucky forums across the Commonwealth. We're working, bringing industry. We're bringing educators. We're bringing our health care providers, our local governments, and our public health officials all together in our Get Healthy Kentucky. And we're looking at things that will improve the quality of health across the Commonwealth. And we're getting a good impact on that. We've incorporated also in our health care plans, and we take care of nearly one quarter, one out of four people. We oversee, or this administration and I oversee, the health care of one out of four people in the Commonwealth. If you add Medicaid and our employee health care system, we cover that many folks. And we put in wellness programs, smoking cessation programs, disease management, pharmaceutical management, which has helped change the health and the utilization and incorporate more best practices. Now, we've got a long way to go, and we'll talk about some investments here. We also have passed some of the toughest drug laws. We've got a new bill we're going to be supporting, and we're glad that, I believe it's already passed out of the Senate now, but a new effort in drugs. But we passed a methamphetamine bill. We've seen about a 57% reduction in meth labs, nearly a 70% reduction in children exposure to methamphetamine in labs. With this piece of legislation, we stiffened the penalties of having a child exposed to this, and it is working. And we've got a long way to go. And let me recognize the Healing Place here. And we have put in 10 recovery centers. And Jay, where are you out there? Jay Davidson, stand up right there. Stand up. He and his folks have done a tremendous job. We put 10 centers across the state. We'll actually be putting another one across the state, modeling after the Healing Place. And we have 1,000 more beds there. We already have 1,000 more beds in our prison of drug rehabilitation. We believe that you're not going to incarcerate your way out of this, that we can rehabilitate these individuals for a much less cost. And our recidivism rate is much, much reduced in these individuals than when we rehabilitate them rather than just throwing some folks that are addicted to substances in with hardened criminals and expect them to come out and change their way of life. It just doesn't work. But places like the Healing Place work, and what we're doing in our prison system works as well. We've focused on jobs and opportunity. As you can see, we've had more folks working. Actually, it's about the 10 highest months of employment in our state's history has been in the last 3 years, the last year and a half or two, if you will. We've had, this says over 104, actually the number popped up to 125, but it's over 100,000 new jobs. And when you're talking about going from a deficit to surplus, it's because we have shrunk the size of government and increased the size of the private industry in this Commonwealth, and we've increased the number of jobs. Additionally, the wages and earnings were up, I think, 6.3% last year as well. So that means that there's more folks making more, and companies are more profitable.
You've been listening to part of an address from Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher to Louisville's Downtown Rotary Club. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher jokes around with two guys who have made comedy their life. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldit. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to be an actor? To learn lines, make sure you follow stage directions, change costumes. Is that what you picture? Well, picture this. Three guys, no lines, no costumes, making everything up as the show goes on. That is the Louisville Improvisers. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with two of them, Chris Anger and Alec Bowles, about improvisational theater, what it is, and how it works.
So what is improv, improvisational comedy?
Well, improvisational comedy is comedy and theater made up on the spot based entirely on audience suggestions. So we don't come up with any preconceived ideas or notions, and everything we do is built in the moment right before your eyes.
So you don't just jump on stage and run around and do whatever you want?
Good improv doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
There actually is, I'm sorry, Alec, but...
Oh, go ahead, please. You're the official spokesman of the group.
Thank you, yeah. Yeah, it's actually kind of weird to actually have Alec here. But yeah. Anyway, no.
He's the mime of the group?
Yeah, yes. He is. He's our...
Normally he just talks about me when he's on your sister's station, and he just mentions my name. So actually to be invited down here is something that's beyond my wildest dreams.
Right. It is. It's a dream come true.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. It's improv on the radio.
And this is what improv is. You know, we're just responding to what happens in the moment. What you say, what Chris says. Improv is just about me. It's mostly about me making Chris look good on stage, and he turns around.
And it's all about actually making your partner look good. I mean, the thing that's beautiful about improv, the thing that I like, and Alec and I both agree, is that it's all about working together. And that's the key to improv, you know, as opposed to running around, jumping and down. And it's not about you. It's about your partner, and it's about the scene, and it's about the idea and building on the idea and creating this moment and this, because it is theater. And
you really have to trust your acting partners.
That's the key word. You have to have a lot of trust. If you have trust, then you know that anything that he says, anything that I say, it's going to be taken care of in a scene, and we're going to have fun with it. And we're going to build into a real scene.
But I think that is the key component to, once again, good improv. It's about how well you work together. Because we rehearse when we're getting ready for a show. We get together, and people say, well, how do you rehearse improv? And you're really not rehearsing the actual bit or the show itself. You're just working on communication.
Do you find yourself, recreating a character, like you fall into a certain character that will come out from performance to performance, maybe not every time, but an audience member throws out a suggestion, well, someone throws out something, you know, similar a few performances later, and you sort of, this character just comes out of you.
I think that's true. You know, I think that a lot of the way we do it, as opposed to, say, some other sketch shows which have built-in characters, I think whatever we do, if we revert to a character or, you know, an idea, is that it's unconscious, because the problem is trying to recreate something that you've done that worked really well before. You know, it kind of goes against the idea of improv, because you'll do a bit in rehearsal or in another show, and you think, oh, that was, you know, that's killer, man, I'm going to do that again, and the moment's gone, and a lot of times it actually doesn't. You don't get the same response.
It never comes back, and then your audience is different.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And audiences are all different. I like to think of it, I have a real problem with doing everything into a sports metaphor, but rehearsing for improv is akin to being on a sports team, in the fact that we rehearse certain situations, we rehearse scenes, type of games, things like that, and all that does is that you get familiar with your partner. You get, as a sports team would run a play, but in a play, like a football team runs, there are so many different variations once you have an opposing team on there. The opposing team in this case would be the audience. The audience stimuli, where you are, what you're doing that night, you know, how you're feeling, how much coffee you had to drink, you know, how your day went. It all affects that. So you have an idea, the play starts, but based on what happens around you, it comes out completely different every night. But by the fact of knowing what Chris is going to do, that he's going to be there, that my scene partner is going to be here, and the more I work with him, you know, we've been working together constantly now for 7 years, I know the way his brain thinks. He knows the way my brain works. And so we can anticipate and trust each other on that.
So with the audience suggestions, the time that I was at a Louisville Improviser show, the audiences both yelled at suggestions, and then they, I guess, deposited paper slips ahead of time. And is that generally how it works? It's Sort of a free-for-all?
Well,
that was a little out of control that night.
Yeah, actually, is that the show where...
all those kids. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the kids. Well, it's actually a specific game that we like to play because the audience loves it because they're even more involved in the scene. And that's a specific game called Paper Chase. And every time we've tried to not do it, the audience rebels because they're sitting there and they're waiting for their line to be read, you know, and so, and we like it because it's fun, and obviously, once again, we have no idea what's coming, and...
Tell us a little bit about that, because listeners who aren't familiar with that particular...
That game, well, Paper Chase is we have people come in, and when they come into the show, when they come into the theater, we have people write a motto, a saying, or a line of dialogue on a piece of paper, fold it over, and throw it in a hat, and then we do it, and then we'll start doing a scene. And then and we say when we set up the game that, you know, at some point during the scene, you know, like in life, sometimes you're not really sure what to say. And so this will be the tool that we use when we're stuck for a line and we're not really sure what to say. Then we'll refer to these pieces of paper that will give us the line that we need to say or we should be saying. And it's great because, once, like I said, the audience gets involved and plus it's just you have no idea. And it's fun for us because as improvisers, we have to justify everything.
So how did Louisville Improvisers come about? Were you just sitting around one day going, hey?
Well, actually, we were in a group called Full Frontal Improv, and we played, yeah.
Well, well, we were actually referred to, and this wasn't a joke, by a place we were playing called Full Frontal Lobotomy.
Right.
And I said
they wrote that on the sign outside at
yeah,
Twice Told.
We said, yeah. Well, is that a review? Or is right. It, so that's actually how we met, but anyway.
And then we left and started our own group with one other member, and that was in the group that group with us. And right. So we were performing, at that point, we were performing weekly
at Twice Told
Coffee House, the old one on Bardstown Road. And, you know, the only improv rule is that the actors must outnumber the audience. So we played for a lot of houses that were 5, 6, 7, which was a great training ground, you know, for us developing our rapport together. Because, you know, when you have five people out there, it's you got to be on, you got to be working, and the stakes aren't that high.
Well, I know on occasion Todd Hildreth will perform with you all. Now, how does the music change your performance?
It's so much fun.
Yeah, well, and actually, when I started doing it back in the Bay Area in San Francisco years ago, we always played it with a musician. And we love Todd, and Todd's been a godsend to us because he can play anything. But it's just... The whole thing, you know, we always say when we teach, you know, that everything you do is information. Anything is information, you know, a look, you know, a sigh, whatever. And the music is just more information. And when you get to work with somebody like Todd, he's just dialed in, and he's used to improvising jazz, that he can add, you know, color and flavor
and
emotion.
Yeah, emotion.
And emotion, because it's all about emotion. I mean, improv is funny. But, you know, like all comedy, the best comedy should be based in real feelings and real emotion.
Now let me ask you about that. Improv is funny because that was always my understanding, is improv is comedy. So in most improv is comedy, but
yes.
Apparently not all improv.
No, there's a lot of improv out there that's not funny at all.
But some of it is intentionally not funny.
Well, yeah.
Well, then, thank you, Alec, and thank you, Robin.
Nights,
no,
yeah. Right.
Some of it's just... painful.
Yeah.
No. Well, when I grew up and you came to Improvapalooza, so you saw my friends and now our friends, True Fiction Magazine from San Francisco, and you know, improvisation is, I come from it, you know, it's a theater. I mean, it's theater and it's art, and without getting too deep, and so you let the comedy come out of the moment, and because the problem is that if you're always going for the laugh. You know, especially in a group, you're trying to top each other, and you're not really listening to each other, and not really working together. That you kind of cut out all this other stuff, which is just as deep, or just as real, I should say, without getting, I don't want to scare anybody off, you know. But it's just, I mean, for me, it's much more satisfying. I mean, it's not life, but on some level, it should reflect life a little bit, and you just have so many more choices that way. And then I think it ultimately makes the comedy funnier.
Well, that is true. If you're always going for the laugh, you sort of lose your credibility and,
right.
And your center.
Mm-hmm.
You lose the reality of the characters. And any good comedy is based on real characters. And in improv, where the comedy comes from, if you're working on real characters with real feelings, real emotions, and you're doing the central improv rule, which is to yes and, to accept everything that happens in a scene. So anything that he says, internally, as the other actor, I'm going, yes, and I'm adding this to there. And if you keep accepting everything that happens in a scene, you will get somewhere that's usually pretty funny or tragic.
Absolutely. And actually, the thing that we always tell people, and the thing about improv is you don't improv in and of itself, it's going to be funny if you follow the rules, yes, and. So don't try to be funny, because you're going to be funny. Improv by itself, it's going to be funny, just because you're supposed to say yes, and, no matter what the suggestion is. And it's going to force you to go in directions that you probably wouldn't go on your own or in quote-unquote real life, and it's just sort of you're forced into a situation where, you bet, you know? It's kind of like, wow, I'd love to have garbage, you know? And just So as long as you agree, it's going to be funny.
Now, as an actor, you have to be a certain type of personality to do improv. I mean, if you have to have your lines or you have to have your stage direction, improv is not going to be structured.
It's going to terrify you. Yeah. Right. I came out of that. See, and I think I had a bad improv class when I was in college in my acting one class, which turned me off to it for years and years. And so I was terrified. How do people go on stage without knowing what their blocking is, you know, where they're going to go, what's my internal motivation? I worked for weeks on finding my objectives and the beat moments and then, you know.
Yeah, grab the glass now.
You're right. And what does that mean? And so when I started working with Chris, I had been away from it a long time, and it really frees you up. And now that I've been teaching it to all our kids at Walden Theater where I teach, I've noticed it's helped their acting in scripted scenes, and it's helped my acting in scripted scenes, because I feel so much freer. Just, I have the ability, I can be in the moment so totally and not worry about anything.
Well, it seems so effortless to the point that, you know, it has to be very difficult.
Yeah. It's not easy. It takes a while.
But, you know, and then we come back to the trust issue, because, I mean, trust yourself, but also trust your partner. And because, I mean, when I do plays, I'm a lot more nervous.
He's terrified. He throws up.
I guess there's the whole, I can actually make a mistake. You know, if you're in a play and you don't pick up that glass.
Right.
Or, you know.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
But in a way, see, that's what improv really helps, that is that if you miss the glass, it's okay. You'll come back and get it. But, you know, that's what I found is the freeing part of improvisation for me is that it's okay as long as you're true to your character. No matter, okay, you miss a bit of business, you can come back and get it. If you have good other actors on stage who are in the moment with you and trust you, you're going to stay true to the author's intentions.
Well, and I think the key is, the great thing of improv is, that, you know, and that's when we teach people that, you know, it is, we don't teach comedy, we teach acting, and the thing is, it forces you to relax.
Yeah.
It forces you to relax and slow down and listen, which is the key to acting and certainly the key to improv.
What type of audience responds best to improv?
Ones that are not drunk.
You would almost think it might be the opposite.
Yeah, you would, but then you have that whole suggestion thing.
Right.
Which is about what you always say. Make sure that what you, if you give us a suggestion, make sure you want to see a scene about it.
Do you think that audiences that go into the improv shows, by and large, know what to expect? Or do you end up with an audience sometimes that won't play?
Every once in a while, you know, that's actually part of the thing when I moved here about 8 years ago and started working with Alec, you know, in this other group, people didn't know what improv was. And gradually, you know, since we've been working together a little over 7 years, gradually people have done it. But, you know, the great thing about our festival is we bring people in different groups, you know, different kinds of improv. And so we'll get people that have never been to a show before, and, you know, they've heard it's good, and they'll think, wow, that's not what I thought. Because we always tell people, I always tell people that, you know, you don't have to go to the comedy club to find comedy. And because that's what a lot of people's idea is, and you know, sometimes you go, and we've been to a few places where, you know, people are drunk, and they're just yelling stuff out, and it's just, you know, I mean, God bless you, but it's not helping anybody.
but that's not this show.
That's not, no. No. And, well, I've never done improv in a comedy club, you know, and I've been doing it, you know, for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And so I just think, you know, that you just, it's a different audience. It's a different vibe. And I've been in comedy clubs and I've done comedy in comedy clubs, but in my personal opinion, a lot of it just deals to the lowest common denominator.
But see, on the other hand, though, I have great respect for comedians.
Oh, it's a different thing.
That terrifies me completely. I could never do stand-up.
Oh.
Because if I'm doing improv, I'm in the moment and I'm playing a character. Mm-hmm. I'm not me, right? And I've got a partner on stage all the time. But stand-up, you're out there and it's hostile because people, they're there just to laugh.
Yeah, or they're waiting for you to fail.
Right, you know, oh my God, I could never do that.
And no, absolutely, stand-up is, I also believe stand-up's an art, too. It's just a completely different thing. And I've done stand-up, so, I mean, but it's a different thing. And they're waiting for you to fail. But the thing about improv and that makes it great is that the audience wants to see you succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
right.
You know, it's the best improv, because they see, because the best moment in improv is when the audience can see you working. And,
right.
It's, you know, it's like, okay, let's see them get out of this, you know. And then if you do it, you know, it's a great, brings the audience
together.
Audiences
love to watch you think, I think. I mean, you were there. What it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we loved it, and I did. I was always waiting to see how you would turn the scene, because some scenes would turn serious,
mm-hmm.
and some scenes would turn funny, and then they would turn again, and then they would come full circle.
Right, and that's when it works.
And that's our goal, absolutely.
Well, can I ask you guys to do a little improv?
Sure.
Yeah.
Improv on the radio?
We can try it.
Yeah.
Can I give you a scene?
You give it to you? Sure. Okay, let's.
Radio sportscasters at a kickball tournament.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you, Robin. Welcome to the kickball championship here at Bellarmine University.
We are so happy today. Hey, and Ralph, it's really good to work with you again. I remember you back from 68, from the finals of the World Kickball.
Oh, the Olympics,
Ralph here,
yeah.
Ralph here, he excelled par excellence. I remember you had that... that kick over the second baseman that scored two runs in the final game.
Right. And I'm sorry they took away my medal, but you know what? I'm still a winner as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it was a scandal. It was a doping scandal back then, but that's okay. All right. Anyway, so today's teams out there, Ralph, you want to fill us in?
Sure. We've got the Bellarmine Kickers, and then we also have the U of L Stompers here, and it's a tremendous competition here. And Denny Crum is actually coaching the U of L team.
He's come out of retirement, yes. He fielded a team for the Stompers, and he feels like he's got a second lease on life now.
Well, you know, and he told me this, and I don't think it's a secret. He enjoys kickball a lot more than basketball.
That's right. His wife turned him on to it.
Right,
she was a kickball star back at Westport in the 70s.
Which is actually where they met.
Yes. Well, you know, he was a little bit older than her at the
time.
Well,
no, and he was just happened to be at the game.
He was recruiting another player then. But
it was Kismet. But anyway, she's still a tremendous kickball. It was Kismet.
Ah, yes.
Sorry, that's not a sports term.
Yeah, he actually got his degree in theater, folks.
Right, thank you. But anyway, it's a great game, and we're looking to a tremendous competition here tonight. The Stompers are coming on a roll right now, and...
They're 8-1 in their last 9 games.
Right.
Scoring 15 runs per game average.
That's true. So that's twice as many as they've usually won.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Robin.
Well, today we've
good
been talking
save,
with...
Good save, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I forgot where we were.
Yeah.
Today,
go Stompers.
We've been talking with Chris Enger and Alec Voltz, two of the three members of the Louisville Improvisers. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks a bunch.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Chris Enger and Alec Voltz of the Louisville Improvisers. For more information, visit their website at louisvilleimprov.com or go to our website, wfpl.org, and click on Studio 619 under the program listing. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to wfpl.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.